So were you able to do the readings? Were they astounding? And you're getting some of the news things and items that were just centered on there. I mean, they're just for your interest. There's nothing, you know, you have to do with them other than look at them if you want. There's an endless stream of vaccine news around. It's like never ending. So, how are we doing on thinking about groups for papers? How many of you have made a plan? And how many of you are lonely, need a partner? So look around. May want to.
How many people are we supposed to work with?
Or can we one, two, I think I said three. So you don't have to do it. You can write your own. It's not a problem. But if you want to, you can. Completely no bias one way or the other. Some people don't want to, like to do their own thing. Others will look for a partner. So if you don't have one and you're looking for one, tell Gila, and we could send out a note saying these are people who are still as yet interested in working with others but haven't joined with other people yet. So we could send that out for you. What else? Next week is Paul Offit. And some of what we're doing today is a little bit of a preliminary to getting to his sort of book review length subject on vaccine resistance and objections. But what we're talking about today is basically concerns about vaccine safety, some of the issues that have come up over the years about why parents may not choose to vaccinate their children, and some of the issues that come up about what are the ethical values that are in play when we're thinking about this. And remember, I gave you that assignment about you're going to tell me why I should or shouldn't get my kid vaccinated. Do you remember this? But just before we get there, just to review the history, remember when vaccines started, they were not actually vaccines. They were that sort of scrapy inoculation thing, but definitely had danger. No doubt about it, they were dangerous. So it is not some kind of myth that inoculation as the forerunner to vaccination could be dangerous. It's also the case that in making vaccines over the years, there have been manufacturing mistakes that led to illness being communicated. The Qatar incident is one of those deals where polio vaccine was made and the virus was not killed enough and it communicated polio. Offit has it in it, it describes this in his book, but it's a notorious case of just a manufacturing error. There are certainly other problems that have been associated with vaccines over the years, one of them being Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is its own interesting challenge or problem because Guillain-Barré is a condition under which a person becomes partially or fully paralyzed and obviously is major and serious for people affected by it. But what isn't so well understood is what the baseline incidence is of Guillain-Barré. So people do get it after vaccination, but we don't know how many people get it, just kind of get it. So that's an unknown. There have been stronger associations in the swine flu epidemic of 1976 when people tried to get a swine flu vaccine out on the market. There did seem to be a higher than usual rate, although it was very low, but it was higher than usual of Guillain-Barré. So that may be a safety issue. But probably the big kahuna in the safety side is autism. And can anybody tell me what autism is that we're all hearing about? Anybody know someone with it, or?
I guess just developmental, sometimes regression, just sometimes global slowing of neurocognitive development, and particularly like social aspects. They don't pick up on social cues, and it's oftentimes begins in younger children around the time when they would be vaccinated.
Just to, I guess, sort of be a little more precise, so I guess autism is on this, there's a spectrum they call it, the ASD autism spectrum is the word, and so autism they often consider sort of the worst or the most severe form, and then you kind of get up to people who can sort of have a little bit better social functioning, like people that have another condition is called Asperger's. And then there's something called PDD, which stands for pervasive developmental disorder, and there are sort of other characteristics that go along this sort of spectrum. But I think kind of the hallmarks specifically of autism are pretty low IQ, so you sort of qualify to be mentally retarded, which means an IQ lower than 70. There are also issues with communication and language impairment, which is not true of Asperger's. So that's sort of one of the defining characteristics of autism. And then you also sort of have issues with facial recognition and social cues. And so they've done a number of sort of imaging studies using functional MRI, I think actually here at Penn, and they recently, or fairly recently, identified specific areas in the brain that are sort of not as active in people with autism when trying to perform skills like, you know, distinguishing between your face and my face. So people can't really distinguish that well with facial recognition. They, you know, sort of a number of other things. And it's sort of, even though autism is considered sort of lower functioning, some people with autism, under the right circumstances and nurtured conditions, can actually do, in some senses, better than people that have such severe impairment socially, for example, people with Asperger's. So there's sort of, you know, this blur a little bit, but it is generally known that autism is sort of the most severe form of this spectrum, I guess.
Anybody want to add anything else?
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask, I mean, isn't that one of the problems in terms of the etiology of autism, since it's a syndrome, not a definable etiology? Therefore, to say that it's caused by the vaccine or the component of the vaccine is a very, very difficult connection to make, because amongst a dozen patients with autism, they're going to have very, very different presentation.
So what's the difference between a disease and a syndrome?
So a syndrome is basically a group of characteristics a group of characteristics that are often seen together in patients. But the problem is there's no sort of definable etiology or cause of those symptoms that are usually appearing. So
a little clarification. It's not the etiology of the cause, it's the symptoms themselves. There's no standard symptom or symptoms in a syndrome. It's a cluster of symptoms, some of which may be present and enough of which are present so that you can cluster them together under the syndrome thing, but it's not cause or etiology, it's presentation. So think of it this way. We sometimes refer to this as a cluster or family concept. You may know that a swan is supposed to be white. So that's a definitional concept which has certain traits, long neck, white. But then there may be other concepts like what constitutes the Philadelphia Phillies. So they turn over. Right? They're not the same. They may not even be the same during the season, but enough of them are there at any given time that you can still identify who they are, even if they're turning over all the time. So it's a sort of membership is defined by having maybe 20 traits, of which any 12 or 13 would say that's it, but you don't have to have the same 12 or 13, and it may not be the same 12 or 13. So in autism, the presentation may be different. So syndromes are on their way to diseases, but there's a presentation that is not yet precise enough, as opposed to symptoms, which are how something presents itself as illness. So you go from symptoms to syndromes to diseases, standardly. That's sort of the evolution of disease concepts.
So I was gonna say there's another way of looking at that too, and that's, I think the quintessential essential one is Cushing's syndrome and Cushing's disease. So Cushing's syndrome is a constellation of signs and symptoms, but they have very clear different etiologies. Mm-hmm. Cushing's disease from other types of etiologies for those symptoms.
This is the kidney disease, right? Cushing's?
Well, Cushing's syndrome, I always thought, if it's related to the adrenals, which is this endocrine gland that sits
on top of your kidneys,
that's Cushing's syndrome. But if it's central, meaning it's coming from the pituitary, and you know it's caused by a defect in the pituitary, that's actually Cushing's disease.
So
please correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, well, I think Cushing's syndrome actually is the... Cushing's syndrome can be the constellation of all sorts of different etiologies. So Cushing's disease is encompassed underneath Cushing's syndrome, which can be caused by, you know, adrenal cell carcinoma, ectopic ACTH syndrome, all the rest of these.
So normally you begin with symptoms. Then you cluster them and you start to get to syndromes. Then you may find that there's a defining symptom which constitute the disease, or you may start to get into what we're now doing, etiologies and causes, to sort it out in terms of subsets. But that's roughly how medicine sort of, we have Gofor syndrome. So last time I looked at that, there were about 15 symptoms. You could have burning urine and irritability, and people had different chronic fatigue, and it sort of was a long list. But it wasn't something that was non-existent. It just didn't make it to a disease because people weren't sure that any classic presentation of essential symptoms was there, and they also weren't sure what was causing it. So it's sort of a cluster of symptoms. And autism is tricky because it has this presentation. It's a spectrum, but it doesn't always have the same manifestations. Those of you interested in this, even Asperger's, I think, is about to get bounced out of the DSM-5. So we had a sort of mild version, and now it's about to kind of disappear back into more the normal range rather than the end of the disease range. And why? Well, partly politics, partly is it amenable to treatment, partly are there enough people in the category to make it worthwhile? And a lot of the people with Asperger's are very upset. They've gotten used to their Asperger status. They don't want it to disappear. It's like a bond among a subset of people that the Aspies are there. Uh-huh.
More than that, you don't want to be considered autistic.
Yes.
You want to be Aspies.
Yeah, separate, but...
almost a prestige.
You can be cool. Aspies are like computer programmers. And
Bill Gates.
Bill Gates and... you know, a little socially awkward, but very intensely focused. It's a chess master. It's sort of, on the other hand, I'm not sure that any of that is true. That's the visible face of Asperger's. Maybe there are plenty of people with Asperger's who don't do so well. I don't know. But anyway,
I know, obviously, each set of statistics will be different, but in general, the statistics that show that autism has been on the rise, mm-hmm. are those evaluating just autism as a far end or the whole spectrum?
They're evaluating the whole spectrum.
Okay.
And since we've had this symptom criteria thing going on, the symptoms and the criteria have changed. Mm-hmm. So that's changed as to what constitutes treatment. It's also political because there's a push toward getting classified because it gets you eligibility for help. So you have a sort of on the edge, put it in because then you can get assistance. Home help or maybe special attention in school. And it's certainly the case, people wonder, well, where did this come from? I don't know that the more severe cases were just not institutionalized and not diagnosed a long time ago is whatever autism has kind of become.
I don't want to sort of prematurely jump ahead, but I think since we're talking about sort of, you know, jumping from symptoms to syndrome to disease, so I think one of the kind of important developments that's actually kind of going on here at Penn is a huge genetic analysis study that's being funded by actually a gentleman that started one of the most successful hedge funds called Renaissance. And he has given a boatload of money to the School of Medicine and the Department of Statistics here at Wharton. And they are doing all kinds of statistical analysis and trying to identify genes and find patterns, all kinds of things. So this could potentially, you know,
move it, yeah.
Move, move this towards disease relatively soon, because they know or they suspect very strongly that actually autism, out of almost any disease, has one of the, or they think has one of the highest sort of genetic correlations. And so they're, I think, trying to sort of prove this, and that would probably be very interesting in terms of, you know, if it turns into a disease from the syndrome.
Yeah, I read something like that too, where it said they did that the studies with twins. If you had identical twins and one has autism, it's more likely that the second will also have autism because they're sharing DNA, versus if you have fraternal twins, one will have it, one will not.
Mm.
So they really think it's a DNA type linked.
And the concordance
syndrome
is really high.
Yeah.
Not just more likely, but it's like 95% likely or so.
And part of the phenomena too is what was mentioned earlier. You can sometimes scan and see differences, so that gives you another physiological base to start to correlate your diagnoses with. Some people have also started to think they can measure the fine-tuned differences in facial recognition or other types of social cognitive recognition early. So that also increases the rate of diagnosis, but it also has a funny impact because it starts to put autism diagnosis ahead of vaccination earlier. So that's kind of interesting. So why would people think that you could get autism from a vaccine? What's the connection?
Perpetuated myth. I mean, I think as the reading was described, the key phrase I picked up was biologically implausible. So when we talk about a disease, we can describe it mechanistically, and we can say, this causes this, this has a causal relationship. But I think, like the Wakefield reading demonstrated, it was this associative, suggested relationship that people interpreted as causative.
And what did he think the mechanism might be for autism? How did he get, he's a gastroenterologist.
Oh, he thought there was damage to the intestines due to the vaccine with remnants of the viruses remaining in the intestines and somehow making it up to the brain and having an effect that would cause autism. But there was a lot of impossibility.
There was never a rationale for that.
Why is it hard to buy the from your intestine to your brain idea? Yeah, it's hard to get things out of your gut. Not impossible, but it's hard. I mean, they don't move through the protections that the brain has all that well, so that makes it a little less plausible. Also, the gut theory was just kind of weird as a mechanism anyway. What else might cause it? What other association? What was the other big?
It was a temporal association. They just recognized all these things seemed
right.
to be going on at the same time. For someone without... for relatively intelligent people who are analyzing this without
mm-hmm.
a lot of education in the background histology, they could reasonably look at it and say A plus B equals C without realizing D is going on.
So if you have a whole lot of folks getting their kids vaccinated in the millions, and some number of them get autism around, or are told that their child has autism around the time that they would be getting vaccines, that's a cause correlation. So it's that certainly is on the minds of many people. They hear that their child is autistic. They didn't hear that before. It came pretty quickly on the heels of a vaccination. That makes them appropriately suspicious or nervous. What else is in vaccines?
Thimerosal.
So the other big issue was mercury. If you ingest a lot of mercury, what does it do to your cognition? Pardon me? Gives you Alzheimer's? Doesn't give you Alzheimer's. Get rid of those aluminum pots. But I mean, what's the mercury connection? Mercury is a toxic to the nervous system. In fact, there's those of you who are fans of Alice in Wonderland, the Mad Hatters are mad because they use mercury to block the hats. So that was an old occupational hazard. And that's what people were worried about with the mercury connection, is that the symptoms of autism connected to mercury poisoning. It's worth a little note on the side. The symptoms of autism do not connect to mercury poisoning. They're not the same symptoms. You don't have pattern recognition with mercury poisoning. You go like completely demented with mercury poisoning. So it was an interesting worry, but it's not quite the same set of things. If you were really getting mercury poisoning, you'd be worse off than autism. It would be bad. As Offit will undoubtedly say next week, amounts of thimerosal used in vaccines, and they were used as adjuvants, not having anything to do with the vaccine, were about what you'd get in a can of tuna fish. If the kid crawls on rugs, there's probably more mercury there than there is in the vaccine. So there's mercury around in the environment. It's in some foods, certainly in things like swordfish and stuff. Remember, they're always telling you, watch the fish you eat at the top of the food chain. So they tend to store those sorts of things in their fats. Anyway, I'm not sure vaccines, even if I got 20 of them on the schedule, would deliver a lot of thimerosal. As you know, thimerosal, that mercury-based adjuvant, was taken out of vaccines a long time ago. Well, nearly all of them, a couple of flu vaccines had them. But it didn't seem to affect anything about the autism rate, so that's probably a disconnect there. What was wrong with Wakefield's study, this gut thing? I think you saw some of that in the readings.
Well, there's a lot of case studies, and you can't. I mean, this is probably going back to what we were discussing earlier, but a lot of case studies, it's kind of hard to, you know, prove your point, and it's even harder to disprove, you know. So you have this, like, semi, you know, valid sort of thing hanging out there without rigorous investigation.
So just reports.
Yeah.
How many cases did Wakefield report on?
12.
So that's not a big case series. It's a little surprising, even, tell you the truth, that it got published. And we didn't make you read all this, but there is more back and forth about this, about why the Lancet took that article and how did it get through peer review, than you'd ever want to shake a stick at. It's kind of interesting. The editor, Horton, is still around, who was there when the paper came in. He's sort of at first offended taking it as a suggestive study and then said, later, maybe we shouldn't have published it. I didn't make you read all this, but if you're interested in the ethics of journals as gatekeepers, the Wakefield study is an interesting case in its own right. Katrina?
I was just thinking a lot of the research he was doing seemed to be, he was trying to link the symptoms to the vaccine and nothing else. So it was sort of a flaw of the
Sort of the mechanism is bizarre, but I see an association. As you also know, when he did his study, he kind of skewed it, I guess is the way to put it. So, gotcha.
Well, I mean, that was partly due to the fact that he was being paid by the trial lawyers.
And he had a vaccine.
Yeah.
So he had his own motivations for looking. He has never actually given up this hypothesis personally. And he does run and has, over the years, run some clinics to take metals out of your body, chelation therapy places, which I'm not sure connects to the gastrointestinal thing. But anyway, I never understood that. But anyway, he's been still big on the I can help you or maybe treat your autism by purifying your blood kind of idea. So I don't know. He's there. He goes. He has a new book out called, I forget now, something like Inexcusable Neglect, and I think that's out in May. I just got a copy of it. It's not out for sale yet on Amazon or anything, but it probably will be within a week or two. So that's a possible. Take a look at the book kind of thing, if that whole Wakefield incident interests you, it's just something to write about or think about. So anyway, bottom line.
Does he have remorse in that book?
No. This is a book that the neglect is the mainstream continuing to vaccinate.
So there were a couple of things about, I had never just read the synopsis of his paper, and I think there were a couple of things that really stood out. One of them was he really didn't have a partner in this. All of his collaborators mm-hmm. were really just people that did bits of the analysis.
Yeah.
So there was never anybody else that really joined him to say, yeah, there's, you know, this is a possibility. And the other thing that feels like is that these were all a bunch of little kids that were like between 5 and 10
uh-huh.
and who maybe all had the symptoms of autism, but then all of a sudden their parents remembered, oh, at 15, 16, 17 months, they all, it all started, variety of symptoms, but they all got colonoscopies, which I just kind of, really is disturbing to me. I guess that's how, you know, it's that if a gastroenterologist is going to look for a problem, I guess they're going to look what the tool they look for. But it just seems like, it feels like someone would have said, what kind of study is this? I mean,
well, it's also odd that it's done through a lot of retrospective memory about what happened when.
Right.
And as I think you know too, it turned out, sort of doing an audit of this, that some of the people who said their child was autistic weren't. So it was kind of a self-report, I think they are, and then they weren't, and out of 12, that's a mess. So here's a little lesson. Or I'll put it as a question. Are there any papers in medicine or science that are breakthroughs? No, there are not.
No, it's rare.
Until something is confirmed, it's not a breakthrough. It takes a second study. There was never a second study on the wakeful thing. Nobody could replicate it. Nobody could get the same finding. So that makes it suspicious. The press, the media, and even the PR offices of medical schools announce breakthroughs about once a day. This is a breakthrough. That's a breakthrough. Great advance. Basically, in the science end, though, you want to look for confirmation before you say something's true. So that's something to keep in mind, that the public, or as we were trying to do education of the public, when people say, what do they need to know? Or even the media, you want to be wary that you don't overhype any single study. Now, an observational report study is not very strong, so you'd really be looking for confirmation there. That's not like the 7,000 lifespan across the lifespan study where you'd maybe give it a little more weight. But I'm going to tell you, I don't think anything is a breakthrough until it's confirmed. So breakthroughs happen on the second paper when they say the first one was right. I've made human embryos, says the Korean scientist, until somebody else does. They're kind of like, well, yeah, it's kind of interesting. Hope so. Very interesting.
And so what do anti-vaccine people say to that? What's their rebuttal to that kind of thing where it was never confirmed, it just was?
They would say his evidence and his willingness to and the ability to confirm it has been done by many other observations, similar observations. The DPT shot is just associated time and again with autism. Parents see it again and again and again, and we don't need any more studies. We can see it right in front of us. It's sort of a natural history kind of confirmation.
So my question is very related to that. I can understand why some people will listen to the media or Jenny McCarthy and just, you know, oh, okay, well, now I should.
I think Suzanne Summers is on this week to talk about breast cancer. So.
So I can sort of understand how people can get confused by the mixed messages. I wouldn't call them mixed, but whatever. But aren't there doctors who espouse Wakefield beliefs?
Honestly, very few. Couple, not zero, but not many. Couple.
Because I was curious what their, exactly, Dr. Oz. That's exactly what I was thinking. I don't know if he's ever come out. I actually didn't watch it, but I know he had both sides of the story on there.
Yeah, recently.
That means.
Yeah.
There are
two people who say there's no problem, and two people say there is.
Right. So, but I wonder what if medical doctor, whatever, other than Wakefield, what could they point to other than his one study?
Parental observation, testimonials. I gave my kid the DPT shot and he was autistic soon thereafter, and just as Dr. Wakefield said.
That might be me, but that shouldn't sway a doctor.
Oh, well, I'm not sure doctors have been all that swayed. Okay. What you might wonder is, should they speak out more? Where have they been? And even the CDC has not been an aggressive proponent of vaccination over the years. They tend to be watching the political pressure, which says, I wrote my congressman, my kid has trouble, and I think it's due to vaccination. The congressman says, okay, then we'll do a hearing on this. And up pops Dr. Wakefield or others.
I just have two unrelated questions. The first one is, So I know a lot of people sort of cite that over the last, you know, 20 or 30 years, like the incidence of autism has like gone up 2,000%. It goes up now like between 15 and 20% a year, you know, almost.
Right. Everybody will be autistic in 50 years.
Right, like one or two out of every 1,000 babies born and, you know, all these statistics. And so I'm just sort of curious how people have responded to that. And then my other question is, has there been, you know, any kind of, the way that people sort of do these studies and say, well, you know, all these kids have gotten vaccinated and, you know, here's the incidence of rising autism. Have there been any seminal studies done looking at children who have never been vaccinated because of parents who are concerned or for one reason or another to sort of demonstrate or investigate what is the incidence of autism in that population? Or is it not big enough population to do that?
It's hard to track that population. So that study, the closest you get to that study is we pulled the thimerosal, or you can watch people who space out their vaccination schedule, but the literal, we don't get it. You'd think you might be able to run that study even in a poor setting, a country of poor people who never get vaccinated, and determine the autism rates, but the cost of assessing a lot of people that way is, so that, the latter one, no, never seen that. The former, you know, it's a subject of a little bit of dispute within the autism community, that some people are just saying, all you're doing is lumping more and more things under that autism banner. It's not really growing at the rate. Other people are saying, well, yeah, you're looking more carefully, and there are more autism experts to go to. So kind of like the tool problem, they evaluate kids, they see autism, they put them in, and the whole spectrum is in. So it's sort of, you're including high function as well as low function. That's deception or deceptive, because what people hear is autism and they think, oh, they're not going to, their child doesn't have a great chance to be interactive or aspire to much. And that's not true given the way they collect. The autism rates are also internationally monitored, and they're not going up at the same rate around the world. They are going up in Ireland, seem to be going up in England and here, but they're not going up like in, Italy at the same rate. So what's that about? And I don't know. But not every nation is watching this autism explosion, that I do know. It could be they diagnose differently. It could be they don't literally have it. Maybe there is a genetic component. So what if people said it might, oh, sorry. Yeah,
I'm just doing this. I think one of the readings, the Offit reading, kind of did like a review on that, and they found that, you know, autism in unvaccinated versus vaccinated, it was like similar. It wasn't like dramatically different at the same rate.
Just not big numbers.
Yeah. And to your point, actually, I think the people who've, like, you know, in one of the articles, it was also that it was said that the people who believe in Wakefield actually gain power from discrediting of this seminal paper in Lancet, because they're like, oh, this is what the establishment is doing. They're kind of trying to suppress him. I think that's the flavor that they,
although, I have to say, the Wakefield discrediting thing, I know defenders will say, well, what do you expect? The establishment is out to get him. I have to say, that discrediting thing is doing a little more damage. It gets a little harder to say, you know, they took him off the rolls, pulled his medical license, he's been condemned up and down, everybody's sort of abandoned him. It's harder to say it's a plot. Not that you can't. You could, but This particular withdrawal is a difficulty in terms of anti-vaccination credibility. I think it is trouble. It's not going to make the anti-vaccination movement go away or anything, but it's probably trouble. A key person is definitely getting impugned. What else might be the cause of increases in autism aside from fluoride in the water and
maternally, parental age?
Yeah, so that's emerged. That's emerged, and that might explain differences in national patterns. So the older parent theory is kicking around.
Other kinds of environmental.
Right, so it could be other things happening.
Other things could be out there.
I was always interested that people didn't go after the tuna fish thing. I tossed it up there as an amusing thing, but it's sort of like, you know, who's eating fish and what, you know. Not that I think you could get to autism from mercury, but you could try for other causes. And so one of the arguments that some within the autism community have embraced is if we continue to bang on the vaccine drum, we're missing chasing down what the real cause is here. So that's a price to pay if you're sort of committed year after year to something that doesn't really have strong support. All right, so let's probably get around to the, I've got a kid and it's time for me to think about vaccination and you're the doc. And so I'm coming, we'll make it into, we'll start with Jamie. So tell me a little, what should I think about? What do you want to say to me about vaccination? I'm concerned. I hear about these, I saw people on TV saying it was dangerous, and what do I need to know? What do you want to tell me?
What are your concerns?
Well, I don't want to make my kids sick. And you're telling me about diseases that we have to get vaccinated against that I've never heard of a case in my, where I live. I certainly haven't seen anybody sick from those things, so.
Well, it's great that you never heard of a case. Why do you think you never heard of a case?
Because the disease is gone.
How is the disease gone?
Petered out.
It petered out due to vaccines, in fact.
Oh.
It's called herd immunity.
So, isn't it gone forever, though?
No, we still, other than things like smallpox, we still have cases throughout the world that could easily come back. There's pertussis and measles coming back in California and throughout the U.S., England. And whenever vaccination rates get low, it could come back.
Is measles going to kill my kid? Because what I heard on TV was the vaccine could.
Well, the vaccine has not been shown to lead to death in any sort of way. It does have some rare and common side effects, usually, you know, local injection issues. As far as measles, measles killing your kid, there is a possibility. There's you can get encephalitis from measles. There's a couple other post-infection issues that can arise.
Kate, well, tell me, what would you say?
That although it doesn't seem like there's an immediate pressing risk to your child, we do know that there are lots of kids who aren't being vaccinated. Which means that there is a breakdown in herd immunity occurring. Also, there are 500,000 people.
By the way, I have to ask you, do you really want to use this term herd immunity?
No, your child is not a cow. Unless it is, in which case that's another conversation. But we also have an obligation to protect the 500,000 people in our country who aren't able to get vaccinated.
I don't care about that. I want to protect my kid.
I think we can appeal to altruism too.
Mm-hmm.
But we also know that, for example, there are kids who aren't getting vaccinated either because they can't, because they have immunodeficiencies or they're on chemotherapies. There are other children whose parents choose to not get them vaccinated. And all of those things can contribute to the resurgence of some sort of infection that could pose a risk to your child. So those are important things.
Zay?
I have a question.
Oh, yeah.
So the question that I have is that, you know, when a number of years ago, I won't say how long ago it was, people didn't question this. The kids went in, got their vaccinations. Parents never questioned, despite the fact, as you were saying, Art, that, you know, maybe the vaccines weren't as good, the manufacturing processes weren't as good as they are today.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it in the culture, the environment that has, or how things have progressed that has sort of changed the way parents and people see this?
Media and the internet. I obviously have no idea, but from my naive and youthful perspective, I think that
internet definitely.
I think that physicians and a lot of professionals—not that they're not respected as much anymore—but I think that to a certain extent, society feels, or individuals in society feel, capable and justified in challenging opinions. I feel like in the past,
although that's on internet, that's a little shift toward more patient autonomy.
Sure, yeah.
So,
but I think a lot of that is a result of increased information that's available to people, to the media being more available to more people and sort of sensational.
So if you have more autonomy plus more rapid information.
Right. And sensationalizing certain things.
Chitty chat.
Because I can imagine back in the day, it was sort of like whatever your doctor said goes. I mean, that's, you know, the doctor's the expert. He or she is a very well-respected community member, and that's how it goes. I think that, you know, maybe with the changes in the health system, with more information out there, with journalism and sensationalism,
mm-hmm.
liking to create issues.
So
I think.
A rise of autonomy nested inside more information, definitely in play.
So I actually had a chance to see Dr. Offit on Friday. He came to Merck to tour the Gardasil facility with 25 of his med students, and
I was one of those med students.
Yay!
It was awesome.
And he spoke to us, and he mentioned that on April 12th, 1982 or something, there was a 2020 or something like that
the
talk
DPG
show
thing in 1989.
With this famous newswoman who's kind of like Barbara Walters of that time, and she had this vaccine report, and I remember him saying that when that aired, I guess he was working with Plotkin, and Plotkin basically was like, oh, holy hell, this just went off, you know, on the air. And basically ever since that, it was like this cascade of dominoes with people, you know, the access to people of hearing this, and then from a respected newswoman, and it just started, which I thought
mm-hmm.
was really interesting. I never heard that before.
I think the other thing, too, I'm sorry.
No,
I was just going to say that the other thing is, depending on what generation you are, there really was a presence of all those diseases. I mean, people saw them every day.
Mm-hmm. So that's diminished. So you're arguing prevention more in a vacuum than you were.
Yeah, when you had your neighbor or your kid couldn't go out and play, and all those things actually really happened.
I mean, I had measles.
Yeah, so did I. I mean, then there was a generation of people who still remembered that as they were having kids, and now it's not so much. I mean, nobody's really seen it. So it's not only an issue of convincing parents, but on the other side, easier to get people vaccinated and to accept vaccination.
Anything else? Mm-hmm.
I think it's self-perpetuating. There's a strong anti-vaccine movement, but there's no counter voice that is as strong. Like, physicians or pediatricians won't actively go and protest in favor of vaccines, whereas anti-vaccination protesters, there's a strong voice.
So there's also patient autonomy has grown, but something else has grown, respect for individual patient values that they have to be listened to. We see it when the wrestler at Jefferson shows up at Jefferson and the parents say, we don't believe in Western medicine, and the first impulse isn't to sort of, you know, surgically brace the spine, but it may be to say, well, all right, we have to listen to what their values are. So there's been a tolerance of more diversity, and I'm going to say, Ted, the culture is more diverse.
Yeah.
There's more folks running around here with different views of things than there were 50 years ago. So you don't have the Hmong and just a lot of diversity has appeared. So you're starting to hear that.
This isn't terribly substantial, but on Saturday I actually saw a Law and Order Special Victims Unit. It was all about, it was called Selfish, if you want to look it up. It was all about, Hillary Duff was in it, yes. all about this case where this woman didn't vaccinate her kid.
Yeah.
Her kid got measles, was fine, gave it to another kid who died, and they charged her. I mean, but as far as like the media and Hollywood, I thought this was maybe the biggest pro-vaccine pop culture thing that I've
seen. Yeah, yeah. Any other ideas about things that could be in play that... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the other issue is just around how we talk about risk. I mean, it's part of the paternalism before, just saying this is what you should do. But now it's hard it's easy for the folks that are anti-vaccine folks to talk about this caused this. It's harder for physicians to actually say this did not cause
well, this. Well, I thought you were going to go in a slightly different direction, which is risk aversion.
Well, both
so the safer things
right,
get,
right.
Small risks that used to be accepted might be less acceptable. I mean, I see this in research risk. It's sort of like any death would be no, whereas I think I mentioned this when Tom Starzl started to perfect liver transplants, try them, killed the first 20 people. They died. You couldn't kill 20 people in a row in a research protocol ever doing anything today. I'd be yelling at you. So, so risk aversion is there.
Of the lost a little bit of sort of the communal purpose.
Mm-hmm. More individualism in the culture.
Right, and sort of interesting sort of within the context that people, you know, the like the anti-vaccine movement and the all the mothers with autism have sort of banded together. They're obviously a group, but the broader, you know, the broader idea within the context of the culture has taken a hit.
So there is a stronger individualistic streak around, not everybody, but it's there. Appeals to altruism might founder, and people would just say, I live in Utah and I live out here because I don't really want to deal with X, Y, or Z, and that's how it is.
Well, I was trying to go back to the risk assessment. For example, in cases where the parents are not as concerned to the extreme cases like autism, but ask, well, I've heard that the MMR vaccine might give encephalitis to my child. So I think a good way to address that concern is telling the parents, well, yes, the vaccine has a risk of 1 in 10,000 cases. But if you don't vaccinate your children and he gets measles, he'll have a risk of 1 in 1,000 of
death measles,
of encephalitis. So I think assessing the risks with the parents when they have this concern, and well, in the case of autism will be the same because now it has been proven that the risk is the same whether or not
although
they're vaccinated.
One point that Jose is making that is relevant here. Remember, parents who are thinking about vaccination, when I innocently approached Jamie about this conversation, and I still haven't got my kid vaccinated yet, want to do the best thing for their kid. This is not a bad thing. It's they're trying to do right by their kid. So it makes it an awkward debate. It would be easier if they said, I don't care about my kid. you know, pain in the ass. But because they're looking out and trying to make a prudential and protective decision, it makes the debate harder because then you're sort of saying, well, I don't know that you're the parent, but I'm not sure you're doing the right thing here, which is undercutting, you know, parental attempts to be protective of their kid. So in how you talk to me, if you were trying to convince me of something, you want to be aware that you don't want to undermine the parental concern, or you may want to recognize it. So I know you're really trying to look out for your kid, but here's some things that you need to think about here.
I think the biggest thing for me is for having parents understand it's not a risk-free choice to not take the vaccine. It's not like you're going to mm-hmm. decrease your chance of getting autism if you don't take the vaccine, right? You're still going to have the same chance, you know, of getting autism. And I think the thing is, as a parent, like, man, I'd be so pissed if my kid got measles from somebody else's kid because they didn't want to vaccinate their kid. So you just, you know, my choice just went away. And mm-hmm. so I think it's important to make them understand that it's not just your choice. You're making the choice for other parents and other mm-hmm. children.
And that's, I think, it's a little bit easier, obviously, with diseases that are around. But last year on my peds rotation, I said we spent a lot of time trying to convince parents to give their children both flu vaccines. And, I mean, that was the risk balance calculation was really what we presented to people who were really thinking in the way you're describing, like, I want to do what's best for my kid, and they weren't coming in necessarily prejudiced, they were coming mm-hmm. in curious and concerned. And that often seemed to work out, saying, you know, there is a real risk for flu and swine flu, and, you know, flu kills this many a year, and there's so many side effects from the flu vaccine. But, I mean, one of the articles talked about, you know, there was a risk in driving here to come here today,
mm-hmm.
and that's often higher than the risk of actually receiving the vaccine. And another thing around that is some of the discussions we have on an IRB I'm on sometimes is about couching, like how to frame risk.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the studies that we were talking about had a radiological test. And we were saying, you know, they're exposed to so much radiation, they try to phrase that. But we were discussing how, you know, people don't think of an airplane flight as radiation risk. Yet, if you told someone that they're going to be exposed to 7 flights to Japan worth of radiation or 50 x-rays, which one sounds worse to you? Mm-hmm. I mean, because I think most people will say, well, 7 flights, whatever, you know, I fly all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But no one gets 50 x-rays on a daily basis, you know.
So one important point here is about framing information and about having metaphors as you try to explain risk that people can relate to rather than just numbers. I don't mind giving numbers, but you usually have to go further. By the way, what we're talking about now is if there's going to be more respect for autonomy and patient values, then how do you get information across? And there's one other change from 50 years ago that's trouble in this area that we haven't mentioned, and that is trust, and particularly loss of trust and faith in the pharmaceutical industry. So the pharmaceutical industry is intimately involved with making vaccines. They are, you know, that's where you look to. So if their reputation is tarnished due to recalls, or people just have come to think it's a bunch of, you know, profiteers or whatever, then the fact that Offit trundles up to stare at the Gardasil manufacturing process is just confirmation that the whole lot of them are in the pocket of an industry that's been going like this on the trust scale. Used to be up there, way down low, somewhere around Bernie Madoff land last time I looked, so way low. So that's a problem, because if you want to give people, you want to respect their decisions, you want to respect their values, they do need information. Some of it is how we frame it, but some of it is who they trust and how do we get them to trust it. That's why the celebrities are important on the media, because they trust them. Oprah is trustworthy. Other people, less so. So I'm not sure what I make of Suzanne Somers. I'm not sure why she's trustworthy. She just must be kind of a phenomenon. But certainly there are trusted spokespersons, the 89, whoever it was, newswoman person who talked about DPT. So one of the challenges in respecting autonomy is not just to give information, but it's to figure out how to provide it in a trustworthy way. That's why I'm saying, if you're talking to me as the person coming to see you, you better start by acknowledging my legitimate effort to try and do right by my kid. I mean, I wouldn't go anywhere away from that. I presume you're trying to do the right thing, and now you need some information so that you can make a good decision. But I certainly know you're trying to do what's right for your kid. Even if you're a staunch anti-vaccinator, you're still trying to do what's right for your kid. So you want to, what we're looking for there is to try and build a trust bridge to the person or the group that, not sure we spent enough time thinking about how to build that. Oh, you're in. Yeah. We jumped you before, but we're back.
Do you think that there is, I mean, I know we talk about things like Tuskegee a lot, and I think it's really important to talk about that, mm-hmm. those kinds of things, but I'm wondering if just generally there is a loss of trust just for the medical community in general, not just specifically pharmaceutical industry, which I agree with you. I've seen that in my lifetime, but I'm just wondering.
Look at Dr. Wakefield.
People tend to trust their doctor, but not the medical profession. So if you go to anybody and ask them, do you like your doctor? They tend to say, yeah, pretty good, yeah. But I don't know about those doctors. So, and they actually have something like that about their lawyers. I like the lawyer that I work with, but lawyers generally as a class, don't like them at all. I don't know why that is. That's all I know about it empirically. So I'm not sure I can tell you why the class is not admired, but the individual that you interact with is more, you could speculate, I don't know. But that's been a loss of faith in the profession. Now, well, I'll speculate one way. Medicine increasingly has become a business. So it starts to lose some of its professionalism and respect as a profession if it's seen as run by MBAs, treat it as a business. If it's an emergency, I'm not going to go in because I'm just an employee, and you can fill this out any way you want. But a price of the market approach is that it pulls away from some of the professionalism stuff. So that may be a factor for docs. Interestingly, nurses are still pretty trusted. Doctors less so, nurses more so.
They're the most respected.
So, no, you know who it is? Pharmacists. You really want to get somebody to get vaccinated, you have to have their pharmacist tell them that it's good, because like, people still like their pharmacist. I guess that may shift as CVS and Walgreens dehumanized the pharmacist, but they were right up there as respected for a while.
Yeah.
I was just going to say one of the ways the pharmacist might actually couch it is the historical perspective over the number of diseases that we've really addressed through vaccinations. Mm-hmm. I think one of the pieces that seems to be really missing in the picture to me today is that there are many very threatening diseases in the world which we do not feel the threat from. And as Americans, we tend to isolate ourselves from.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many countries around the world that, you know, would give anything for rotavirus vaccination because their babies wouldn't be
dying. Measles.
Or measles, mm-hmm. any of the ones that we have. And most of us don't really think about those or know about them. But I think as the world gets smaller and transportation moves people around, you know, I think the figure is 300,000 cases of dengue fever, I think TB, and some of the places that, you know, diphtheria, there are still problems in the world that actually are going to come to our shores.
I know there are problems in the world. That's why I moved to Utah.
Yeah.
I understand perfectly well that the world is dangerous and I don't like it and I don't want anything to do with it. And I certainly don't care if they're all dead in dengue fever places because I don't want anything to do with that. I'm going to. So the Fortress America thing, it's a tricky thing to play with the foreign threat or the invasion of the body snatchers or whatever the hell it is that's coming, because people sometimes will withdraw from those kinds of threats and just say, I like living in a community where I don't have to worry about that, even though the truck might come or the, you know, even the Amish are not isolated in any real sense. I don't know that any community really is from what you're talking about, but it's tricky. It's a tricky thing. They tend not necessarily to say, I'll protect myself against them. They say, I want to isolate myself from them.
Going back to the trust thing and having so much information available, like on the internet, and a lot of people, patients feel like they can look things up themselves and they have other avenues to get
mm-hmm.
information just besides. And I think that kind of undermines the patient physician relationship and the trust there.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. I think there is, when you have more information, I think there is a sort of expertise is a more available, so I could find it out too. It's not that I just have to talk to you. So let me repeat though, if you're trying to achieve, and we think it's good that there are more questions or people are asking more than they used to, one question is, if that's a good, then how do we get choices that are based on good information? We've said things like framing, metaphors. We've also got a trust issue because it won't take your information unless there's some reason to trust it. And so if I say I'm going to have a Merck-sponsored vaccine conference at the Franklin Institute, I have trouble. I just do. It's already in trouble because some people are going to say, well, I don't know about them. I'm not sure I can trust them. If I have a nurse-sponsored forum, I'm probably further along the road of something. But trust becomes something I have to build.
I think your point about sort of partnering with, you know, the patients and saying, you know, your intentions are good here, that, you know, you want to protect your child, you also are concerned about doing the right thing. I mean, I wholeheartedly agree with all that, and I in no way mean to sound flippant by saying this, but sort of bringing us back to a discussion that we had, it was three classes ago, and we sort of discussed the employee from CHOP who was fired because he refused to get the flu vaccine. I mean, none of this would all in some sense be a moot discussion if vaccines were mandated.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm not kind of taking a stance one way or another, but I think a potential way of looking at this is sort of from a somewhat philosophical, you know, social contract perspective, that, you know, the way that we sort of agree to live in the society, in this country, and the way our constitution is set up as part of the social contract, and that we have certain responsibilities to not infringe upon other people's liberties and all this other kind of thing, which is why, you know, there are laws against all kinds of things. You know, you can't litter, you can't
mm-hmm.
do all kinds
mm-hmm.
of things.
Your autonomy is limited in
some
ways.
Sure. If the government were to say, look, you know, your lack of willingness to vaccinate yourself is going to hamper the security of other people, and if you refuse this, then we will either, not necessarily quarantine you, but we will fine you severely or punish you for not upholding your part of the social contract the way that people all the time are punished by going to jail for doing certain criminal acts or fined for not paying their taxes, or in some cases even sent to jail for that. I'm just sort of curious.
So now you took me exactly where I was headed next, which is, all right, so we've relied on choice and liberty. That's been our opt-in vaccine approach. You get your kid vaccinated, except that we have some mandates, right? We've put in some, can't go to school, some other pressures have been applied that make it not just 100% pure choice, although easy outlets, you could homeschool, probably get a religious or philosophical or some kind of an exemption relatively simply. So what you're talking about now is that fair or is that just? And when there are actions that I take or things that I don't do that impact others, like smoking and secondhand smoke, where does my liberty get limited and why? So one reason is you're going to maximize the benefit if you have mandates or a little more compulsion. The benefit for, you know, group immunity, the benefit for individual children. If we took away some liberty, we'd just get a greater return on health for people who can't choose for themselves. The parents are making the choices. They need some protection. So a standard argument to not just rely on choice is that you're going to maximize the outcome of good. A pretty clear consequentialist one. But I wanted to put some others on the table for you to think about limits to freedom, unless somebody wants to try to think, what else could we use to justify a liberty intrusion in terms of what's fair or just?
I think the issue is, I think mandating doesn't erase concerns, though, I mean, if the goal is to just make it a non-conscious act for people to mm-hmm. get vaccines as much as it is for me to say, okay, I brush and floss every day because I know it's good for me. people say, okay, I do my vaccines because that's the right thing to do. If perhaps mandating will achieve that and make it unconscious effort, but I think the other part of the matter is that we're looking at, you know, when people don't have a relationship with a doctor, perhaps they don't have a regular doctor, and it's too idealistic to assume we can make that change, but I think the heart of the matter is that people don't have an avenue for communication about the ideas, and I know there are for some physicians in the room and would say, like, there isn't enough time to talk with every patient.
Yeah, no, that's a problem.
Perhaps also tying in the trust issue is
one of the ways that this has become a problem in terms of trust and getting trust is where there's more efficacy in medicine than there used to be 50 years ago, but there's less time to talk to the patient. So that's been a trust problem. It's nice that efficacy is up. I'm not sure I would swap back to the, I've got plenty of time to talk to you because I can't do anything for you, but I can certainly talk to you. So, but that's unhinged a little bit some of the trust in the physician expertise. A lot of physicians today are seen as technical or operating technology or something. So that's an issue.
So by efficacy,
no time. I have good outcomes. I have a pill that'll help. I have an intervention that'll do you good. I have dialysis. I have devices. I have things I can use and fix you. But I'm busy. I got to monitor all this stuff and insert it and manage it so I can't chat to you about it. And I'm not that interested in your family situation. What I'm interested in is that you take this pill or we get this tube inserted. So I don't need to chit-chat with you so much anymore. I don't need to know you so much anymore. And in fact, a lot of the care has moved into hospital-based care as opposed to home settings, right? Who shows up with a little black bag and a lot of chat from 50 years ago? That person isn't around too much. I won't say gone completely, but pretty, it's a rare species. Somebody mentioned something about a reason of justice that you did. You said you should get vaccinated because there are people who can't, right?
Right.
That's an argument from protect the weak. Mm-hmm. So another, aside from maximize the good, there is an argument that you have or society has an obligation to protect the worst off, if you like John Rawls, or protect the weak or the vulnerable. And so there are weak and vulnerable people who can't do anything, and they need to be protected. So you might get a second justice claim going to take away some liberty or tamp it down a bit on grounds of protection of the weak or trying to make the weak better off. we talked about this last week. What's the problem if I say, well, I'm glad everybody else is getting vaccinated. That's great. I don't want to put the risk on my kid, so you all do it, and I'm cool with that. What's wrong with that?
It snowballs.
No, I think most of you suckers will do it. I'm just not going to do it because I'm pretty, I live in Chestnut Hill. They're dutiful. They're not going to omit vaccination for their kids. I'll just slide by here. Oh, don't give me that mutated stuff. I'm just going to rely on my neighbors to take the risks, and I'll get the benefit. What's wrong with that?
Your neighbors rely on you, the ones who cannot get vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a healthy individual who becomes infected and could have otherwise been vaccinated, you can spread that to people who are...
So it could be a harm. Yeah, maybe.
And also, vaccines are not perfect. So even though they are taking some risk, mm-hmm. they are still at risk of getting the disease. But if they get the disease being vaccinated, it might be not as hard as when your child, that has not been vaccinated, it will be perfect.
So nobody just wants to yell at me for freeloading?
Jerk.
The sort of jerky freeload argument. So this is called free rider arguments.
Yeah.
And the conditions for fairness or justice limiting freedom, again, to come back to the point, are if I consistently take a benefit, knowingly, I say I'm going to take the benefit of the immunity, but I do not want to carry the burden. It's one thing if the newspaper guy accidentally delivers the newspaper to my doorstep and I read it and it was a mistake. But if he brings it every day and I don't say anything and I keep reading it, at some point you start to think, you should pay. It's not right that you take advantage of this. Or if I'm sucking down Comcast, signals and not participating in the community cost of providing the infrastructure to have them. There are a lot of situations where people free ride. We don't condemn somebody who either accepts the benefit accidentally, the newspaper misdelivery, or can't escape it. Maybe I don't want it, but I can't. Wi-Fi is everywhere. I don't really care about it. I don't want to use it, but I can't. I mean, it's just there, so I can't do away with it, but I don't want to pay for it. Things that are beneficial that you are a part of, there is an argument called no free riders or a free rider argument that says, no, you have to get vaccinated too. You can't just slide here. There's something unfair about you relying on the actions of others, and the risk should be partly yours. It's just fair. You have to distribute the risk fairly. So that's another kind of argument, just to repeat. Maximize the benefit might limit liberty. So might protecting the weak in the case of vaccines. So might free ridership arguments. And there's actually a fourth one that I could think of, and that's one we've mentioned a few times, but it's almost never said in the American context. It's an act of solidarity. We never use that term, or you might say community if you want, and people have said it here tonight, but most of Europe would say, we get vaccinated because we are in this together. Canada might say that, America less so. No politician has ever trotted out solidarity in my earshot, but, I mean American politician, I've heard it in other countries, but there is a value in and of itself of saying, a community will look out for its members. If you're a member of a community, you have to show concern for your fellow citizen. You can't just hide from them or withdraw. So out of social solidarity, that value itself will allow us to restrict your liberty because there are certain common things of common interest that we will pursue together. That's what it means to be a society, not a bunch of hermits. Now, some people may respond and say, hermits? I like hermits. Hermit sounds good to me. But you get less of that in other cultures than you get out of America. I'm serious. Have any of you ever heard solidarity appeal to? Check. Look at health insurance debates in Europe or vaccine policy debates. You're going to see solidarity pop up really fast.
Same with unions, right?
Yeah. So that's another value you could try for. I'm not sure it's one that Americans want to commit to, but it is one that you could sort of generate. And that, if you had solidarity, then you'd have a duty to others. It's not just to the weak, you'd have it to everybody, so to speak, to try and maximize health, minimize harm kind of thing. So where we started out, just to recap, we do have more vaccine resistance, some of it based on different fears, some of it based on legitimate history, some of it because there probably is some risk. It's hard for people trawling the internet to say what's a real source, an invalid source, or maybe there are sources there that make them nervous that they trust more than they do drug company sources or medical groups because of their wariness of those. And we want to respect diversity of their views. So the problem now is we're not going to go back, I don't think, on the respect for autonomy line. So what we have to do is figure out how can we get information that they will act on and make prudent decisions about. And that's a combination of how the information is presented, the framing, the metaphors, and all that, plus trying to make it them present in a way that we are trustworthy sources of information, which is its own headache, but really important if you're going to fight with, you know, Oprah or Dr. Oz or other trusted sources of information. You've got to have that trust. Some might say then, look, I don't want to do away with autonomy, but it has to have its limits. It's too risky. We can't have measles outbreaks. We either have to say you need to get vaccinated or forced to get vaccinated, or we need more mandates, or refusals have to be harder. Those are the justice arguments. And those are the ones I was trying to run through with you. It's going to just deliver more health overall, so let's do it, which is the classic consequentialist override of liberty. But there's also protection of the weak. There's an argument about don't have free riders allowed, so they all got to come in. There's a notion of social solidarity you might be able to play to. So those are arguments on the ethics end that you might put into play.
So while I do think that those are strong ethical arguments, and I think that they can be used to support a mandate, I would be hesitant to use those with a parent just because I feel like you're like, hey,
yeah,
do this for the other kids.
Yes. I think what I'm talking about here is a little more policy-oriented than it is. How about that free rider thing there, pal? Remember the newspaper delivered to your house? So, no, I think these are more at the policy level of saying, overall, we're going to restrict liberty or put in more mandates or at least up the ante on what it takes to get out. Let me flag something for you. In international vaccine policy, do we get anywhere close to respecting autonomy in most places? I don't think so. So it's very interesting to get the benefits in poor nations. I don't see people whipping out informed consent forums and refusal forums and telling me about your philosophical differences and blah, blah, blah. They're vaccinating them, and they kind of run through the village and say, open your mouth, and rah, rah, rah. I mean, it's not. So there is also a bananas asymmetry. We have this whole liberty-oriented, autonomy-driven vaccine policy here, and is practiced out in poorer nations. There's very little autonomy in a lot of these justice arguments in play. You know, we've got to max the benefit, or it's probably max the benefit as the driver. So forget about mandates. They don't have any mandates. They just don't have any informed consent. When we get later to the eradication disputes about disease targets and trying to eradicate disease, one of the interesting things is how hard are you going to push autonomy? If you don't push it much, you can get further on eradication than you're going to get, you know, I'd like to see eradicate measles in the U.S. with a strong autonomy, respect for autonomy position. Very, very impossible is what you're going to have. Because no matter what we did, there's going to be some core people that are just not going to get vaccinated. End of story. Unless you force them, won't happen. So there's always going to be a reservoir of some disease, and you wouldn't be able to stop vaccinating against it no matter what you did. Whereas elimination of polio in a lot of the world is not driven by the teams that come to do the sweeps are not carrying informed consent forms. Last time I looked, they may chat with you a little, but I don't think they're saying, you know, there is a philosophical exemption, and if you go down to the headmaster's hut, you can file this paper, and you'll be allowed out of today's vaccination effort. It's not there.
If the parents refuse, the kids just don't. I remember just reading Gawande's book and his chapter about like how the parents refused, and they just didn't vaccinate that kid.
Yeah, but if you come back 10 times.
Then eventually.
So, yeah, I'm not even sure I believe that completely. I mean, I believe his story, but I'm not sure I believe that that's how it's practiced. Yeah, yeah. I've never watched a vaccine sweep, so I can't say, but in listening to them secondhand, they're aggressive. They're really aggressive, and they're not oriented toward, I mean, you certainly wouldn't be saying, have you thought about whether you want to do this or not? You'd have to sort of say, I don't want to do this, you know, on your own. It wouldn't be. And as I said, there's no distribution of exemption forms. The kind of thing that goes on at here is not taking place there in the PEDS office.
I was just going to offer a kind of a historical perspective, because I guess I was a parent during a time when chickenpox vaccinations came in. And so there really was no discussion, but there must have been a lot of peer pressure as people started to you know, other parents, you need to get your kids vaccinated, especially mm. chickenpox. Because it was always seen as a disease. It wasn't the worst thing in the world, but you were going to lose a day of work.
Mm.
And so there was kind of the component of inconvenience, and inconvenience to other parents if you didn't get your kids vaccinated. Because at some point in their life, they were going to get it, and you were going to be miserable for a week with a child that was sick with chickenpox. So I think as it came in, it must have had some real social pressure that just said, we all need to do this, because I don't want to miss a week of work sometimes.
You know, there are relatively few women over the age of 35 who don't get amniocentesis or some form of test. Now, some women don't because they just aren't going to do anything about it, but exempt out that group of people who wouldn't end a pregnancy no matter what. And it's interesting because that particular attitude has not been formed by a government policy. Nobody passed a law. It's all peer pressure, completely peer pressure. People just sort of go to parties and say, oh, you're over 35. Did you get a, you know, you're thinking about amniocentesis? It's like, what is this, Chinese communist village? But I mean, it's sort of like, you know, really going to have a second kid? I don't know that that's advisable. So peer pressure like that can work. I know what you're talking about. It's worked, I think, in the genetic testing area over the years, too. There's been no organized push from anybody to push for that kind of testing. And yet it got into the culture as the responsible thing to do. So shifting the norm is an interesting challenge about vaccines. Dave's case... I always thought, for you lawyers here or people interested in legal issues, is there liability if I could show that your kid gave my kid the disease? I don't know that the science is up to the tracing of the causes for everything, but it's an interesting concept. If we don't want to do it out of solidarity, you could do it out of hostility. So you make me sick, and that's the secondhand smoke argument, then I'm going to restrict your liberty because you can't make my kid sick. Sick, make my kids sick too. So that maybe the science isn't up to it. I don't know. I mean, people tell me, you know.
I wonder if they would be criminally up to it, but civil. I mean, they can genetically test for the strain of the disease, and if they identify people who were sick with it, and there was only one or two that you came in contact with, it would seem that that would be a preponderance of evidence.
Yeah. So maybe there's something there.
I think that would also be hard to. I think that would be hard to hold up too, especially if you've got like a measles outbreak in a community and a whole bunch of other people have the illness.
And people do come and go and all that. But
I think it would be. I think you're right that you would have hard evidence, but I don't know if that's like really substantive evidence that would.
But it
be.
Is interesting to ponder. I mean, that's a possible paper there, sitting there, sort of like, what would it take, or how would it work, or could you do it, or could it be done? What would it be like to try and file that lawsuit in California with the outbreaks?
Is it just a strict negligence theory?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you'd probably be looking into the secondhand smoke literature for your precedents to sort of say, you can't put me at risk, or you can't, or uncovered pools, or, you know, sewers without tops and all the rest of it. There's a bunch of analogies you might try for here. But it's an interesting, it's a possible idea. All right, one other thing I wanted to talk about, and this does relate all the way back to Ted's question, because something else is in play about trust and sort of the loss of faith in vaccines. We have this big compensation system that was set up. Now, it doesn't take a big genius to decide if you have a big compensation system set up, there must be some reason for it. The reason must be that vaccines are dangerous. What's wrong with that argument?
The reason for the vaccine. for the compensation system is so the vaccine makers will continue making vaccines so they don't have to deal with various lawsuits.
I think that's probably the core of it. It really is there as a tamp down of suits to keep the industry viable. It's not a concession of safety. But if I was to go on the internet, one thing I see a lot of is, if there isn't any problem, then why is this compensation fund created? So that's another reason, Ted, that things are, people have seen this thing out there and they see awards and things happening, and it must be for some reason. So they don't associate it with a social purpose of trying to keep the vaccine manufacturers in the space. They see it as an admission that it's also a no-fault system, so it tends to pay out for kids. You don't have to go through a lot of effort to get a claim paid, and it's been generous just to be kind. But that may concede the harm of vaccines in a greater way. Going at the other end of things, I'd be interested to see what people thought about, should the vaccine for compensation fund be changed? Is it set up the right way? Is it too liberal? There are special masters, all kind of people get involved in adjudicating requests. Is it evidence-based? Is it sympathy-based? Is it a kind of giant social transfer to just somebody who's got a kid who's sick and you say, okay, give him some money, you know? A lot of juries in malpractice cases, they don't care why Mr. X got injured. They just know that Mr. X is broke and there's somebody with a deep pocket and let's give Mr. X some help. That's all. It's not, you don't win those cases necessarily by having an elegant causal argument. You just sort of are trying to, the jury's sympathetic to the needs of the person who seems to have needs, and there's a lot of money sitting at HUP or something, or they have a big insurance policy. So it isn't always just, you know, cause and effect, but that may set up expectations and problems by having a generous compensation thing. Now, I did concede that there are some side effects that have been associated with vaccines over the years. They're not perfect, and so some of those payouts may also be rooted in reality. The big autism claims have not gone far with the vaccine compensation fund. So they've not been sympathetic to that. They've turned them down, as far as I know, all of them, and have not bought any of the arguments saying the evidence is insufficient. Diehards will then say that proves that the fund is in the hands of the pharmaceutical industry and the doctors, but that's at least one forum that I think the autism debate in it by itself has been not recognized as valid. Yep.
So I have a question about the table vaccines. So what does one need to prove, if anything, other than a temporal relationship?
That's all.
Just temporal, no causation.
Got vaccinated, got sick. And it's based on that notion of we don't want to fight about it. In addition to protecting the manufacturers, the other idea I think behind that stance was, if anything goes wrong, we'll take care of you, so please get vaccinated. It was a kind of safety net, but I'm not sure it's completely worked that way at this point. Now it's become it's not a safety net, it's a you must need it because the damn things are dangerous. So it may have been turned around on its head a little bit in terms of how people perceive it. I haven't seen surveys of what attitudes are about that, but if you look on the internet again, you can get a lot of buzz that, what's this big fund out there for if they're all so safe? What are they doing there? So one might have started out with one intent, may not be there anymore.
Question about this Hannah Pauling case that was referred to. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us more about that?
This was the woman, the girl who had two doctor parents, and she had difficulties after vaccination, and the parents did not believe it was autism, but they thought something may have happened from the vaccine that caused their child trouble. And this is what's known as the mitochondrial problem. Yeah. So some people think that the mitochondria, which are like the cell's batteries, may in fact be damaged or hurt by something that's in vaccines. It's not clear how you'd get chemicals or information from the outside world into your mitochondria. They're pretty self-contained little units within the cell. So that becomes speculative. But the other problem is kind of like Guillain-Barré. Nobody knows what the baseline incidence is of mitochondrial disease. It's very rare, and she may have had a disease or a genetic, you know, not to get too wacky here, but the genes in the mitochondria are separate from the genes that are in the main genes of the cell. And they get passed on separately and sort of move that way, but they can mutate and change too, so you get diseases in them that are exceedingly rare, because if the battery that drives the cell's activity has a problem, you're going to be dead most of the time. That's why they're rare. That's about as far as that story goes. So the parents thought, no, not autism, but she does have a mitochondrial thing. Maybe that's the connection to vaccine harm. Other people said, we don't really know what the causes of mitochondrial disease is. They're very rare. There's mutation. We don't know the baseline.
So the reason I asked in part was that we've heard of someone else, just personally, we've heard of somebody else who had some kind of mitochondrial disease and actually received significant compensation from the vaccine fund as well. And so just not knowing a lot about it, I was curious, having seen it in this paper here, and if it's there, if it's that rare in the population generally, is there any real causal association? It's just...
No. And it gets back to the question. They're kind of compensating just because it happened and it's around vaccines, and you might say it's an act of kindness more than an act of confirmation of something.
They've compensated for things like fibromyalgia and restless leg syndrome and like multiple sclerosis.
Yeah.
Have no association.
So that's what I meant when I said it might be interesting to take a look and see whether... That's the right stance. Are you doing good by trying to be kind, or are you sort of fostering more vaccine distrust because you're just, people hear these things and, you know, then they assume that you've got a cause and effect thing, and that's what a court wouldn't do. You know, what court is going to make an award unless there's a cause and effect? This one. But most people don't, you know, they watch TV, they know what happens on Law and Order, they got to prove your case. It's it's not some kind of a social insurance program. In fact, this is a social insurance program, so it's a very different model that people aren't used to.
Can I ask a follow-up to the legal question that was raised earlier? So there was a case of a kid at CHOP recently who died of the flu, whose mother just decided not to vaccinate her kid for the flu. So in a case like that, the parent isn't bringing harm to someone else's child, they're bringing harm to their own child. And that seems to me like there would be legal grounds for negligence there. But I don't know if that's ever been
tested. Well, the standard of care is to allow parents to exempt. So it would be very hard to hold her to any kind of liability. It's sad or tragic, but since it's part of law that you can exempt or waive out, you wouldn't then be able to charge her with negligence.
But we charge parents with negligence, like, if they decide not to take their kid, like decide not to give their kid an antibiotic if they have pneumonia,
pretty rarely.
There was a case.
I know, but it's pretty rare, and you don't win them. You can charge them, but if you say, well, let's put it this way: there might be an expectation that parents have to notify medical authorities if their kid is very sick, and a failure to do so might result in a prosecution. But they ain't going to jail and nothing's ever going to happen to them in that sense, because they've lost the kid and we're acknowledging that they tried to do what was best, even though they should have contacted medical authorities. You don't win those kinds of medical neglect cases, force of law, they tend not to be big winners because judges and juries are very sympathetic to the loss. You may peek into the family to see if there are other kids. Social service may take a look and say, well, you know, remember the family that had that terrible starvation thing going on with his kids? So they looked at the other kids. I saw they were starving. They moved him out to foster care. You may try to do something protective that way. But generally, those are tough. Those are hard because you sort of lost the kid and they tried to do the right thing from whatever lights they were doing. So you might get a prosecution, though, on a different thing. I think there are parents who get prosecuted if they don't put their kid in a seatbelt or a chair. One of those kiddie chairs. So there may be affirmative duties created to say the expectation is you will do this and there is no exception. But vaccines do have the exception on the books, so I don't think you'd get four. So you're looking more for the car seat kind of analogy.
Right, right.
But it's not set that way right now. All right, well, so again, I'm not going to repeat the thing I've said 450 times tonight about how to implement autonomy, but as we think about the vaccine refusal movement, there are a lot of factors in play in terms of information sources, what's trusted, what's lost trust, what's lost faith. We have some arguments of justice that might be used to further limit liberty or restrict exemptions in certain ways that you can think about. I think that that literature is not very ample either, so there's opportunities to write about that. I've never seen much in the way of a good ethics article just overviewing the how the theories of justice might limit liberty in the vaccine space. I just haven't seen that article. And next week, when Offit comes, you know, you're listening to someone who is a fanatical loon, pro-vaccine as they come. And I say this, he and I go to basketball games. You have to listen to this malarkey night after night. He comes from a point of view. He has a spin on it. He's angry about the anti-vaccination movement. But he's probably someone also who's dealt with them in terms of face-to-face debate and conversation more than anyone. What's probably most interesting about Offit is that he's lonely. There aren't a lot of docs who've engaged the issue. So that may be an interesting question about where's the rest of the troops? Years ago, when Terry Schiavo was in the news, I spent a lot of time on TV arguing that the husband should be allowed to make the decision. And I kept looking over my shoulder for somebody to show up to like back that position, because I knew a lot of people were sympathetic to it, but nobody ever did. AMA never did, religious groups never did, nobody did. In general, when something gets controversial these days, a lot of people shy away from the public interaction, and you might say, just hanging this last question, is medicine doing its duty? If vaccination is so important, then where is the cadre of people? I mean, it's Paul Offit versus Jenny McCarthy. It looks like, you know, that's it? That's what we got? I mean, nobody else? No one can mumble coherent sentences in any forum publicly about vaccines from the infectious disease or pediatric or even ethics community or industry community? And I sometimes think it's Jenny McCarthy and Jim Carrey, the, you know, sole opposition to, I mean, that's all we're ever going to hear about is, and Dr. Bob Sears. I'm not sure I would say that the field of medicine has done right by vaccines, and you already heard me sneer a little bit at the CDC. So I'm not sure they've been vociferous. They are not anti-vaccine, but they are quieter than you might expect if this is God's gift to public health. And they're the public health place. So, you know, where's the Surgeon General or the head of the CDC? They should be on TV every night engaging the vaccine issue. Where are they?
Why not? I mean, it's really striking because, I mean, of all the things that